I just want to thank you for attending the session 121 titled P Words. Before we begin, we ask that your cell phones be turned off and those attending will be respectful and attentive. It is the mission of Sunstone to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue. Please keep that in mind when engaging in the Q&A portion of this session following the remarks of the presenter. Those who cannot abide by these guidelines should refrain from commenting and will be asked to leave should they become disruptive. This session will be recorded and you will be able to purchase it after Sunstone. You may also consider purchasing Skullcandy official headphones customized just for Sunstone. This session is 60 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework of that time so we can allow for the next session to start on time. As a courtesy to other presenters and our attendees, we ask that immediately after the session, you clear the room and speak outside so other presenters can begin preparation for the next session. Starting with primary, pioneer, and polygamy, then prophet, priesthood, and patriarch, and now pride, P Words have been a strong presence. Oh, is that you? I'm sorry. Okay. So I'm just going to turn the time over to our presenter.
I thank you for coming. Honestly, when I saw who else was speaking at this time, I was tempted not to show up to my own session. There are great things going on, so I appreciate it. I'm covering a lot of P words, and so it might get a little whimsical. I'll try not to spit when I'm saying the P words into the mic, and you might want to just listen for a lot of them, and they change all the time. But it's interesting that in the presentations I'm doing, I'm covering a lot of P words. But I'll at least touch on them in this one if I don't cover them to your satisfaction. We will have some questions. About 30 years ago, an area authority in Utah Valley, and he was actually a relative of mine, he was giving a talk to a large audience, and he spoke of attending a sacrament meeting where a newly baptized family was being presented to the ward. And it consisted of parents and several daughters. And the father of this family had been baptized a few weeks before so he could receive the priesthood and baptize his wife and daughters the day before this sacrament meeting. The bishop of the ward saw this as an opportunity to kind of have this teaching moment at the podium, and you know how well those go. So after sustaining the family as new members, he invited the youngest daughter, who was 8, to come to the pulpit, and he asked, "What special thing happened to your family yesterday?" She said, "Well, we got baptized." "And who baptized you?" "My dad." "Why was he able to baptize you?" And she's like, "Because he's my dad." And the bishop said, "Well, no, he has something special that makes it so he can baptize you. What does he have that no one else in your family has that makes it so he can baptize you? It begins with a P." And she said it. Now, the area authority didn't say penis, but he made it very clear that that is what the girl said over the podium in sacrament meeting. And then he emphasized the importance of not getting those P words, penis and priesthood, mixed up. This was in the 80s. We still have a big struggle with P words. I think of this when I consider, don't equate an appendage with the amazing power that comes when we live the qualities described in section 121. Of the Doctrine and Covenants, and we will come back to that. I also looked at the meaning of a lot of other P words in my life. It has become important to create my own powerful meaning around words which dogma and tradition and bias might attach the actions of judgment, exclusion, abuse, control, or condemnation. Some of my earliest memories of primary were in the LDS church house in Menlo Park. We lived in Palo Alto, and we attended the ward in a building that was just like a castle to me, and I return and I go, when did it shrink? And I loved primary. I loved seeing my friends from junior Sunday school. We came during the week. We sang songs. It was fun. There were actions to them. We had activities. It all blended with socializing with other families. I loved singing. One of my favorites was the primary colors are 1, 2, 3, red, yellow, and blue, and I would sing it to my friends at school. I like knowing a song that none of them knew, and explaining like it was the coolest thing that I belonged to a church that had come up with this magical thing that there are these three colors, and from those three colors, every other color in the world comes from these three colors. And that was brilliant. It was proof that I belonged to the right church because of primary color theory and inventing these three colors that could create infinite pigment possibilities. B words. I felt the church had to be true if it were the source of such amazement. And I wasn't concerned about what each color stood for. I just liked the idea of this magical thing that could happen. And with it, the songs and the colors and the friends and the games. And most of all, I loved hearing about Jesus being my friend. And I particularly remember a lesson. I probably wasn't older than five. And the teacher gave us a picture of Christ standing at the door knocking, waiting for me to open the door. So in primary, Christ was always there. And that's what I do when I serve in primary. Christ is there. I don't care about anything else except that the kids get that Christ is there. After all, where else would he be? So even though we lived in beautiful Palo Alto, where the biggest mountains were maybe a couple hundred feet tall and it never snowed, in July, we would talk about our Pioneer heritage. And to me, Pioneer meant family. We would be so excited. Mom would scrounge clothes that would somehow imitate the look of a pioneer. We would pull my little wagon as we walked to church for our Pioneer Day primary, and I was so thrilled when I was big enough to pull my younger sisters in the wagon as we trekked around the block. And I was a pioneer. I was this good Mormon girl among so many who didn't know about pioneers and the importance of sacrifice in the pursuit of truth. And along with that, polygamy. Another word I was so proud to know that none of my friends had any idea what that meant, and none of my friends had a great-grandfather who was a polygamist. And so I had a certain amount of pride attached to that. In high school, where I was the only Mormon other than my siblings, and by this time we lived in Minnesota, I decided to write my final history paper on my polygamist ancestors because my teacher had condemned Mormons because of polygamy, and it had riled me. I figured I could impress my teachers and my classmates with how accurate and honest my description of polygamy was, how it was really like, how positive it was because it was practiced only temporarily. There was this proper purpose. I wrote to my grandma, and I asked her to give me her firsthand information. And even in my enthusiasm, I could not mistake that my grandmother was not writing enthusiastically. She shared details and certain feelings to an extent, but she was not forthcoming in a lot of things. And later when I looked, and she was very generous, she wrote a number of letters to me in longhand about this, and she was very generous, but I look back on that later and after I'd read other journal accounts from other family members, and I was impressed at how she was able to give me information about her own life without sharing the great and deep pain it had brought to her precious mother and her kind father. Deep pain. And when I was fortunate enough to get a job working in the church history department when Leonard Arrington was his historian and was able to spend time there in the Camelot years, I read more firsthand accounts that did not try to hide the pain. And I stopped trying to justify anything about polygamy. When I made polygamy personal, that was when I opened my heart and mind to how wrong it was. It was just wrong. It was common to hear eternal polygamy referred to, not always jokingly, as something we would all need to accept and practice. This was BYU in the 70s. I was relieved when I asked my dad about it to hear him say he did not believe it was an eternal principle, and I was grateful for the many talks we had where he really asked me how I thought and how my siblings thought. And I appreciated his essay on polygamy, fidelity, and eternal marriage, where I saw many of the conversations we had had show up in a larger framework as a case against polygamy. And I felt it gave me armor and powerful tools so I could respond when others would repeat the dogma of what they assumed was an eternal principle. But none of that could completely prepare me for the proposal, or should I say the proposition, We had dated for a while, this young man and I, and we had become serious, even discussing marriage. But then I learned he had been dating others seriously at the same time. And so I stopped considering him as anything other than a friend, a former boyfriend. And we could occasionally hang out or go on a casual date, but I figured we'd gradually move on and eventually stop seeing each other. And one thing that really helped me let go of any serious thought was one evening when we were with a group of friends and polygamy came up, and I did not hesitate to firmly say I saw it as a temporary 19th century practice, not an eternal one, definitely not required for salvation. I did not appreciate the assumption that somehow when I'm righteous enough, I'm going to love it and accept it. And so I'd come a long way in those few years since high school, and I was surprised to see that he was upset. He was furious at what I was saying. And that just made it easier for me to see, okay, not this guy. But then after it had been, sometime later when it had been a few weeks since the last time I'd seen him, he suddenly came by for a visit, very distraught. And I learned that the woman he had been dating, that he had started dating while we were serious, but she had been killed the night before. He was driving, fell asleep, car rolled, she was killed. And so I didn't hesitate to be there to help him comfort him. This is what we do. This is heart-wrenching. And I never considered it as anything other than what a friend would do. But after a few weeks of kind of being there and helping him process things, and I was with him as he was making some school arrangements, he started talking to me. He told me that he felt it was time for him to move forward with his life, and he wanted me to be aware of how I would be a part of it. I'm still a bit amazed at how calm I was able to remain as he told me that he was planning on being sealed as husband to his now-dead girlfriend. Her parents were in favor and would participate in the sealing. I tried to ask questions about how that could happen without sounding too appalled at the thought. And then he started talking about how he had no intention of remaining celibate in this life, and that we had once talked about possibly getting married, kind of half-seriously, as a plan B if other things did not work out. He then asked me to marry him with the understanding that I would be his second wife and that I would need to understand, and I quote, what my station would be as such. I still managed to remain calm, even as I said in a passionate but even voice that once again I did not believe polygamy was an eternal principle and was not interested in this life or the next in participating in anything like it, and that I would never be willing to be any kind of a plan B in any kind of marriage, and that I had no doubt that God would be as appalled as I was at the thought of it. Trying to remember that this guy was still probably in shock. I am really glad that I had realized long before this that this was not the guy for me, because I don't want to imagine how painful it would have been to hear this from someone I was in love with. As it was, it hurt. It hurt a lot. How could someone treat me like a possession? Possession. A servant to fulfill a temporary mortal space until his first wife was resurrected and could take her rightful place, and I should happily slip back into second spot, plan B. And how many others would he want to line up after me? And what if his dead beloved didn't want to be the first of however many he thought would be only too willing to take part in this so-called principle? That experience became something powerful beyond the pain. A practice that I would develop for many other things. So after that, I never hesitated to point out how ungodlike polygamy was and how it contradicted the message of love and fidelity and commitment and value and. Anytime it was brought up, every time, all the way to the present, it was also my own litmus test, and I would ask anyone I dated what they thought right away. And some didn't pass the test, and I am pleased that most men I knew did not like the idea. And women who went painfully silent if the subject came up would almost cry in relief when I would condemn the idea of polygamy. They too seemed to be glad for the armor, the logic, the affirming power of the reasoning behind rejecting it. The complex and still largely incomplete history of polygamy is very connected to another P word, profit. Who did what? Said what? Who wrote what? When? To bring about the prophecy of polygamy, and why? We don't know. We're doing what we can with what we have, but ultimately, it's a mess. Can a man be a prophet, a very weak vessel, as described by God, to bring about such beautiful scripture as Enoch's weeping God, and also fall to the depths of the terrible actions surrounding polygamy? Is it all part of the paradox of humanity? The very human journey of trying to find our way to God, the moments of seeing God, and the terrible things we do out of fear or doubt or anything when we aren't willing or able to find God in each other. And prophet becomes person, seeking perfection just like me. Are the men I see as prophets, both beloved and fallen, within one person? Are they still in the process of trying to heal us from the blood and sins of their generation? Will they ever heal themselves? Is eternity what it will take for this to happen? And this leads us to priesthood. My early memories of priesthood, it was just why my dad wasn't there before church on Sunday. He was at priesthood meeting. And then one night when I was hurting and shaking with pain and fever, Dad and Mom stood by my bed together. He held a small vial that became familiar to me in the coming years. I felt a warm wetness as he poured a few drops on the top of my head, then a comforting weight as he and Mom laid their hands on me. He spoke words of healing, and priesthood had something to do with it. So from childhood on, I remember the words of Section 121. No power or influence can or ought to be maintained by virtue of the priesthood, only by persuasion, by long-suffering, by gentleness and meekness, and by love unfeigned, by kindness and pure knowledge, which shall greatly enlarge the soul, without hypocrisy, without guile. And that is what priesthood was and is to me. I am amazed at how much time and energy is spent talking about what the priesthood isn't, and it involves many P words. Possession of a penis, permission from a leader, piano moving, placing of chairs, patriarchal protections, proper progenitors, pre-existent actions, perceived valiance based on privilege, prejudice, prolonged age, prepubescent persons with XY chromosomes, power, power, power. When I was young, I don't remember hearing about any teachings about gender and priesthood, but I soon linked power and priesthood. God-like power, power to heal and lead, not compel, not force, lead, inspire. And that power involved all of us turning to see and exercise God's power, which could only work if we used it as God would. It was an immediate switch to turn off if it was not used as God would. It did not exist otherwise, regardless of how much someone claims that they can have it and carry it in any other way. I really don't know what needs to happen before we put at least as much energy and time talking about and exercising what the priesthood could be or is as we do talking about what it isn't. Somehow, because it must, the conversation, the actions will shift. The qualities described in 121, what I feel is one of our most true scriptures, must prevail, and we are meant to turn to our godlike power, all of us. My grandfather got patriarch thrown in there for me. He would talk about how we needed to remember we belonged to him. That in the next life, he would be there on his throne with us gathered around him. Now, I know this is shocking that I would talk like this to my grandfather, but I would say, yeah, well, what about your dad? What about my dad? He didn't want to talk about that. So we bring in the paradox. Because my grandfather was an amazingly Christ-like man. It was just phenomenal, the things he did in his actions, while the words he said sometimes just jarred me to no end. So paradox became a very familiar word. And Joseph Smith said, by proving contraries, truth is made manifest. And we're going to be talking about this in the panel this afternoon, moving beyond black and white thinking. But my nuanced belief began when I was a child. I don't know what kind of a difference that made compared to learning it later, but paradox was a crucial part of my development. And it just became the norm. If things didn't seem to match up, it was just another contrary. It was another paradox that would lead somewhere. It would invite more thought. I didn't expect things to line up, to have easy answers. So the process of proving contraries is a path, ongoing, always fulfilling, never fulfilled. And speaking of parenthood, yes, I admit that I used to think that's what it means to multiply and replenish the earth. But I have come to realize that that charge, promise, practice is so much more than breeding. I know of others who have learned this and live it without actually giving biological birth, and I'm not trying to minimize or maximize any aspect of that. But what I've come to think is I really do think we multiply life and replenish the earth when we presence God, when we create the experience of eternal life now. What if, just what if, the most important way for me to multiply and replenish the earth is to help create a world where all want to live. All want to live. Suicide is not a P word. But it comes into this. All want to live an inspired and inspiring life, even when it is difficult, and that they feel they have the help to do it. Maybe the most important work I can do in my calling as a member is what I did a few weeks ago when I sat with a young friend who is virtuous, lovely, and good, and of good report. And I listened as she told me how, because of Orlando, she doesn't feel safe in the world. Because of comments by a leader and a fellow youth member, she doesn't feel safe at church. And of her concern because she has lost dear friends to despair and suicide. I have no easy answers for her. And that's the paradox. We're not here to give each other answers because there are none. All I could do was mourn with her, express my love for her, and my promise to share her burden, hoping it will be lighter for her. And all of my efforts pale in comparison to her courage. This seems to be where parenthood has brought me, in awe of those who come after me, in awe of parent gods who sit with me, mourn with me, love me where I am. How could I have anything to do with this, with these beings that somehow are connected to me? And because I love them, as long as I love them, they always will be. This kind of parenthood helped me see that the true sealing power is love. Period. Is this how God became our parent? Somehow, somewhere, they learned to love us in our beauty and ugliness, our glorious successes and glorious failure, our turning away and our embracing, our gratitude and blaming, our joy and heartbreak, our listening and our walls and barriers, and on and on. God chooses to be there, feeling with, hearing and seeing, present, choosing us. Is that parenthood? Is that what I am learning? Or just glimpsing? And am I learning? Am I to learn it as a parent? Or learn from being the child? As I see my own children sharing their journey and not always willingly. Privilege. I still hear it referred to as something that has raised you to a higher level. Be grateful you are privileged. And make the most of it. Your life is easier because of it. And always the veiled reference to worthiness. We like to look at what we consider privilege, especially if we have it, to somehow mean that we were more valiant, deserving, or better than. I have been surprised to see that my true privilege is not what I pictured for my life when filling out a list of goals in school or seminary. My greatest privilege has been a life that has not been predictable and that did not follow plan. My children did not follow a prescribed plan. They are not what I expected them to be. They are so much more. My marriage is not what I predicted. It is so much more. God is not a being with parameters that can be quantified. They are incomprehensibly more. I am privileged to have children, spouse, friends, family who are on a spectrum of gender, of expression, of faith, of thought, of everything. And my love, faith, and power is constantly being confronted, re-examined, torn down, and reconstructed. That is privilege. What I expected, my planned life, is constantly something I can lay on the altar, let go, and create a place for something greater, unexpected, something miraculous. What some would consider problems, those are my privilege. My so-called wayward children that people have come up and pitied me for. They are amazed when I tell them I would not change a thing. My queer and creative and courageous and confronting and brilliant and frustrating and powerful and active and beautiful and strong and unique and loving children, I could not have planned anything like them. Love would still have been just a concept, a Sunday school lesson where we try to justify setting conditions on it. Now I have begun to take into the very molecules of my body, letting that be the fuel that brings me life, and there is no condition, and it is terrifying and glorious. I will not spend time on the most painful current P word, policy, because I address that in the devotional I'm giving tomorrow morning, but one thing is very clear, and this is something my husband said as bishop to our ward last December. The gospel of Jesus Christ is not policy or programs or procedure. It is people. I said in the last gospel doctrine class that I taught before my stake president ordered my brand new, not yet out of the wrapper bishop to release me and not let me teach again. Quote, we come to God one by one, person by person, but we can only learn to approach God by how we connect to each other, our relationships. If we can't learn to see God in each other, in each person, how can we ever approach the divine? And a big P word for all of us, the past. All of the past, everything before this day, for good or ill, prepared me for this day. What do I do with the preparation? Am I a prisoner to what has gone before? Or do I powerfully choose freely, appreciating what the past is, not letting it control me? Do I powerfully create possibilities, many unheard of, never before considered, in that terrifying moment, and it is terrifying, of wanting to hang on to the way things were, to the predictable, or let go and step into the not yet known possibility of a new life, now and now and now, always a new life. This is the rebirth that Christ offers, as whether it's a part of a group, a family, a church, a partner, a path, a person. Is that what progression is forever? Is that perfection? Perhaps it is. We have time for questions. I'm not worried. I'm fine with a pregnant pause. I'm trying to think of a P word about tweaking it. Any questions? Do you want me to expand on any? Do you want to share any P words of your own, whether they begin with P or not? Yes.
I do. When you have state president, Jesus will let you teach and participate and
That's interesting. I'm not there because of him. I'm not going to leave because of him. And I'm not trying to make light of it either. It has been hell. The question is, when a stake president does something like that, how do you stay? Yeah, it's been hell. But I think part of this has been a really amazing experience for me in the months that followed that, because I continue to be a temple worker, and that has been very important to me. But what I did is I returned again to being totally guided in my service by God. I don't need a calling or a correlation to tell me how to serve. And I mean, I always have served when I'm led to in so many ways. How many of us really serve mostly in ways that are not related to any formal calling? We really do. Yeah. We really do. I'd like to see the calling they'd name yours, Kimberly. But being reminded of that and really focusing every day. And at the same time, you know, I didn't feel that I had to stay cheery and active. I on Sunday mornings or before there was anything that would cause me to be in one of our stake buildings, I really pled for help. I was just like, should I do this? And there were times, no, you don't have to do that. But most of the time it was like, if you don't have to be there if you don't want to, and there is work to do, and I'll let you know what to do. And things have happened where I have spoken, I commented and said exactly what happened in Relief Society. I talked about the atonement of Christ just being there with me in my pain that had nothing to do with sin, had nothing to do with doubt. It's just because people had said things that really hurt me and that were based on lies and gossip and who knows what else. And it hurt. And a lot of people came up and said, thank you for saying that. This is why my husband doesn't come. This happened to me, you know. So I'm glad I was there. Other people who you know, asked me to tell them what was going on. I did not hide a thing. And people are sharing things more forthrightly. Leadership is having to be more open. And now we're moving back to Utah. So, you know, it led us to ask different questions, which is leading us back to Utah, which, believe it or not, I have found some incredible wards. Oak Hills 4th, Yale Avenue. I've got to find out this one that's over in Mill Creek. There's another one in amazing things that are happening with LGBT awareness in Highland. This is what happens when you serve in non-correlated ways. You start connecting with people who are saying, hey, you know, get over here. Our stake president doesn't care if you're a member here. We have stuff to do. So, you know, those horrible walls we build around ward boundaries and stake boundaries don't need to be there. So that's something. Yeah, and I have complete understanding for those who that's not what they choose to do or are led to do in the midst of something like that. Absolutely. It's completely personal. Yeah.
So Carolyn's written this wonderful book. I don't want to necessarily solicit comment from you about it. But in your presentation you talked about things that you studied and you read at the Church History Department. When you look back at polygamy, do you deconstruct it? And at what point do you stop deconstructing and reconstruct it, or do you not bother to reconstruct polygamy in your own matrix? What do you do with polygamy?
I've gotten into the habit of deconstructing everything. But as far as our history goes, I think the most important thing we are to do is to be with it. We can't fix it. We can't justify it.
So in your deconstruction, do you decide, do you have to agree with yourself to stop at a certain point? Or do you have that discussion?
By deconstructing, do you mean trying to explain it?
Mm-hmm. Sending these men off to missions. At what point do you come to say, okay, this is a rat's nest of stuff, and I don't have the capability intellectually, which clearly you do, but I don't have the capability emotionally to rip it apart because it's too hard? Or as you work back through this intellectually, do you stop at a place where you decide not to go back?
No. I think we have to take care of our own health, and everyone's in a different place. I have not had an example in my life of any way to separate the intellectual from the personal. I really don't. And again, I was probably the greatest privilege in my life was my father. He did not separate. There was nothing about him, his intelligence, his seeking, his journeys, his struggles, all of it was connected. And it was always connected through Christ. That's just how he saw it, and that was my example. And to internalize that to the point that I made it personal. So when I am studying, when I read, when I look at sources, and when I see where those sources came from, my daughter works in the archives right now. And we talk about source and we have no idea. Something that supposedly was written by Joseph was never touched by him. To everything is everything could be anything. And so that lends a whole new layer to all of this. I can't begin to put myself in the place of Joseph Smith. All I can do is be with the consequences of what happened, and what do I do with that? What I do know is there are things that came from Joseph Smith that have given me so much life, and other things that are so appalling to me. And to me, that has taught me how completely I can see that God will work with us in all of the ups and downs, all of the great things, all of the failures. Because I do believe God worked with Joseph, and I do believe that God was possibly furious with Joseph and with Brigham and with everyone since then. And that's really, really, it's a rat's nest, but that's how humanity is.
So you're the prophet of God's furious with you. And you have a red telephone. And you have a telephone that
tells you. I don't think the prophet has a red telephone.
No, a white telephone.
I don't think it's a white telephone. No, I truly do believe that the prophets are as likely as any of us to shut our ears. Yeah, I really do. I think the prophets are as likely as any of us to decide we already know, don't have to ask, and we're going to figure out a way to make something work according to what we already know. Oh, yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. If that's what you were trying to get to. Yes. Yeah.
But it certainly feels like within the past 10 minutes that there's a dearth of silence coming from him.
Yeah.
And we can rewind.
Yeah. Well, it's the church may be as true as the gospel, but the corporation is not as true as the church. And we are dealing with a corporation. The church is still there, the gospel, to me, the church is still there, the gospel is still there.
And it sounds like, I mean, we don't talk about it. And this could be a long, long church we have. And I don't want to take time on the people
I've never tried a microphone before.
This is Kimberly Anderson. She is a force to be reckoned with.
Stop it. Is there going to be two layers of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints moving forward?
I don't know.
Where there's a layer of insulated, top-level or orchestrated leadership, and a second layer of non-correlated, believing, committed members that take it into their own hands to decide who and where and what to serve. Because I'm seeing that in the past year and a half that I've been doing my thing, I'm seeing that pretty fiercely within our group of women. I'm just wondering if that is spreading and becoming larger outside of a narrow band of thought or activism, if there's a larger ethos of that across the spectrum of Mormonism.
I think that's something that we're here to learn from each other. Because in any given time, we are each in our own part where it could be insurmountable, totally immovable, completely silent, so entrenched in dogma that you are seeing people literally die spiritually right in front of you. And you could go to the next meeting that meets in that building, and it's a completely different experience. So, and I don't think this is a new thing. I think this has been going on in different ways for a long time. It's just, what do we do with this kind of level of bureaucracy when the church has grown like this? I don't see how it's sustainable. Exactly what's going to happen. I think we're hearing a lot of options and ideas and experiences. I do know that when I speak with people who are further away from Salt Lake, there are some pretty amazing experiences of the gospel. I look at that movie, Meet the Mormons. Bishnu is phenomenal. I think, yeah, the church really is true elsewhere. And the same thing is happening here in different places. When it says Zion really is created in your heart, we take that with us. It could happen in this room, or a room could get completely mired in the dogma of I'm now enlightened and the whole thing about the church is completely wrong. That's dogma. That's immovable. That's entrenched. That there's no possibility there. You know, that can happen anywhere. So I don't see it as a different thing that any of us, including our leaders, are as likely to shut our ears to something new because we really are sure we already know. Why ask if we already know? I can see Brigham Young really thinking he had to do something to keep the saints unified, insulated, and protected. I don't justify it. I don't think it was right, and we are dealing with the impact. But he was doing, you know, what he did. Can I try to untangle it? I don't know. But I think it's important that we do sit with it. I had a really amazing experience one time in the temple when I was doing ordinance work, and that whole blood and sins thing, it was like, it was, how many of you have had that experience where all of a sudden pure knowledge is just pouring into you? And that was my pure knowledge. It was just this experience of seeing generations still doing what they could to heal. From the impact and for the impact. And so the cleansing goes on. And I don't know how to figure it out. It really is a matter of being with it and bearing one another up. Yes. I'm not sure. You mean when I was talking about how... how I think, you know, Brigham Young and Joseph Smith and everyone who came before us, they're still working to try to heal others for the impact of what they did and heal themselves. I don't think it's a done deal looking at what we do here at all. It's one of the most powerful things I can do is get that the relationships go on. The veil is fluid. And I can't explain what's going on now according to what happened almost 200 years ago and vice versa, but I can still be with it. Is that clear as mud? Any other questions?
Not really a question as much as maybe just an alert to anybody. Carolyn, who Kimberly's mentioned her book, towards the end of it, really wrestles with what you're just talking about, how they're trying to heal, but she's also talking about how they're cheering us on now to help in that process of the healing. And so she has these imaginative visions that she does at the end of the book that just talk about, Joseph cheering anybody on who's doing things like your dad with his amazing essay and this perfectly wonderful, let's do some P words on this powerful, perfect talk that you just gave. You know, all of these things are us being healers as well.
And I remember when she first told me about it months ago and she was doing the survey and gathering stuff, I was so appreciative of, I mean, Carolyn, oh my word. The courage to just say what is coming to her. And again, it's not like she's speaking the truth that all of us should have. She's speaking what she is experiencing, and people are connecting to it. But it's one thing that I really appreciate because I feel that, and it doesn't mean that someone's wrong not to have that experience, but talking to her about how fluid the veil is and how it can be so thick and rigid, or it can be very thin and fluid, and how the work goes on. That's another promise that we have. Our work on the earth is not done. Ever. Theirs isn't.
She has two more P words, from patriarchy to partnership.
Yeah. And it kind of goes back to the, talking about the whole priesthood thing. How many of you truly feel that we spend a lot of time talking about what it truly is? It's unbelievable. The efforts, the time, the talks, trying to justify something that has, I just don't see how it has anything to do with what the priesthood truly is. Well, and in section 121, it has another pure, undefiled, undefiled, undefiled. Yeah. So I think we can be capable of getting back to getting the crap out of the way.
I came in late, so I apologize. Did you cover the P word, performance?
No.
That's my P word.
Go ahead. Tell us performance.
Well, I mean, identity is, whatever else it is, it's also a performance. And I felt once you started talking about what the priesthood is and how we spend so much time, agonizing over what it is, I thought, yeah, I have to say something about performance, because all of this is performance. We perform whatever identity, whether it's Mormon identity or corporate identity or university identity or whatever, we perform those for different audiences. and
All the World's a Stage.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I just wanted to contribute that, if that's helpful. I don't know if you have any insights into how you see performance figuring into your larger schema. I'd really love to hear it.
I think when I think about that, and that's excellent, thank you. When I think about how we are performing, we feel this desire to say the right line, to get the right response, to get the standing ovation, the tears. It starts with just getting that's where we're at. We're in a play, and we've written it ourselves. Every one of us, we've written our script, whether we're aware of it or not. We have written our script, and we're in the play. There are a few things that are more overwhelming than the desire to look good. So once we notice that, and another P word is being present to it, but be powerful about it. Look, if you're going to write a play, do something that works and makes a difference. I think the greatest theater in the world is in London. I love going there. It is the greatest, most affordable theater in the world. And I'm not talking about the great, big, flashy West End productions. Those are the most expensive ones there. I'm talking about the ones that are in the little theaters. I just saw Richard III, probably the greatest Shakespeare productions I've ever seen. Ralph Fiennes was Richard III. Vanessa Redgrave was Queen Margaret. It was in a theater that seated maybe 100 people. I was sitting 2 feet away. I have Ralph Fiennes spit on me that I didn't want to wash off. It was the most incredible, intimate, overwhelming, repulsive experiences of my life. His role as Lord Voldemort was a warm-up to this. It was so powerful. And she brought women front and center in that production. And it cost the equivalent of $35. That was a powerful experience. It wasn't the flash. It wasn't the most popular. You're not going to see it on some hideous reality TV thing. But it is changing lives. It changed mine. That's what theater can do. If you're going to write your play, make it powerful and make it have a difference. Stop worrying about the billboard or how many people are in your theater or how much the tickets cost. There was a hand down here. Yes. What time is the panel? 5? Okay, we have a panel this afternoon, Beyond Black and White Thinking. And really, it's all about that, the polarization. And one of the things I'm going to talk about in my presentation is one reason to, I mean, we are black and white thinkers, that's what we do. But in doing that, we kill each other off, and that's what polarization is. What we're seeing in the world, in the church, and it's going to happen. I mean, it's just the nature of what we're seeing is we kill each other off. It's a form of war. Because black and white thinking compartmentalizes. There's my way of thinking. I am right. It's a three-letter acronym of war. We are right. And everyone else might as well be dead. And if they're not, I will make sure they are. So that's where we start, is we recognize that's how we are, and then we do something from there. Time? Okay. So if you can come, that's going to be, I know that there's some really interesting things being said at that. 5. Mm-hmm. And tomorrow morning is when I'm addressing the policy. I did not skirt that. Just letting you know. Yes.
P word I'd like to hear you talk about maybe is protect. How do you protect
I would love to have an answer to that. I have a child who for 5 years every night I was worried I was going to get a call. Couldn't do a thing about it. And the only thing I knew I could do is to text, "I love you," several times a day. The only other option was to lock that child up. And it gave me a glimpse, tiny, tiny little glimpse of what it's like for God. They weren't going to lock us up. So ultimately, I think we protect each other by acknowledging how amazing we are and by loving each other. One of my heroes is a fellow mama dragon whose son committed suicide last year. And unfortunately, I have several other heroes for the same reason this year. And one of the things I learned from her is to love her son as he is. And he chose to leave this world for whatever pain he was in. And the love continues. That is the greatest protection we can give, I think. I hate the thought that I may never get over the concern that that is a possibility, but I can still love. And ultimately, that's how I feel God's protection. Through things, you know, my first world problems of having stake leaders who just don't want me there. But in the midst of it, I have experienced so much love. And that's protection, I think. Anything else? I think we're out of time. Thank you.